Greetings, I'm Reinhard Wolf, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. The show is normally hosted by Henrik Palmgren, but I'm currently filling in for him while he finishes repairing the damage done to our site in the recent attack. For those unaware, Antifa, or at least a group claiming to be Antifa, wiped our websites and servers during a very complex hacking operation. Fortunately, none of the damage was permanent, and we'll be coming out with a brand new members website in a few weeks. If you support what we do here at Red Ice and you want to help, please consider making a donation at paypal.me/redice. Our guest for today is Nick Fuentes. Nick is a 19-year-old college student, political analyst, and the host of America First. For months, he's been under attack from the mainstream conservative establishment for daring to voice controversial opinions on multiculturalism, Israel, and immigration. To his credit, Nick has weathered these attacks quite well, proving that refusing to budge is the best way to respond to such politically correct social shaming. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Nick, thanks for coming on the show. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. So, Nick, why don't we start off with kind of your basics in terms of your background and what you're doing these days and so forth?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Nicholas J. Fuentes. I am a student currently located in the western suburbs of Chicago. Right now, I just got parted ways with Right Side Broadcasting Network, but I'll be starting my podcast America First back up again on Monday, and then on Saturday I'll be starting a podcast with James Alsup called The Nationalist Review.
Awesome. Yeah, we just had James on the show. He's a great guy, and I think that's going to be a very promising podcast, to be sure. So let's dive into the main topic now, which is essentially these attacks that you have been subjected to as of late. It seems like they've come from both the right and the left. Both sides are attacking you for essentially having the wrong opinions on a variety of issues. So why don't you just kind of start us off from the beginning and tell us how this came about?
Sure. Well, I mean, this has really been about a 9-month character arc that I've been battling with against the Reagan Battalion. This all started in December of 2016, if you can believe it, with the Reagan Battalion, which we've now discovered their identity. I know a lot of people have been working on this for a long time. We've now discovered who they are. But previously, we had speculated that this was like old boomers from the Rick Wilson camp, from the Ed McMullen camp. And they started going after me with Cassie Dillon, Elliot Hamilton, a lot of the Daily Wire people, Ben Shapiro included, because of my position on Israel. And, you know, it's funny. It seems to me that really the cucked right and all these so-called conservatives on the right have done a pretty good job of red pilling normies and regular conservatives better than people like Richard Spencer. Because, you know, I started out from a very moderate position, which was Israel should not be receiving the amount of aid that they are. It's just obscene. And I got horrible attacks. I've had a horrible onslaught of attacks from them, really uninterrupted for 9 months. And so this has been going on for 9 months that Reagan Battalion, Cassie Dillon, the Daily Wire crowd have been submitting hit pieces on me to Media Matters, have been tweeting at me, calling me a racist, a Nazi, an anti-Semite, and all the rest. And then obviously since Charlottesville, they've only kicked it up about 10 notches. And I understand everyone in this new, more nationalist strain of the right wing is feeling that. I know you guys yourself at Red Ice, didn't you guys just get hacked last week?
Yeah, we were subjected to a very intense, a very intricate attack. Fortunately, we have been able to pretty much recover from it entirely. Our member site is still down, but we've used this as an opportunity to create a new member site, which we've been meaning to do forever. So we're actually going to come out of this with a better setup.
Yeah, well, that's good. But yeah, I mean, I know it's just obviously this is not an uncommon experience that a lot of people are really feeling the heat after Charlottesville, from Hatreon to Stormer to, and, you know, I don't even support all that stuff, but I just think it's a really, really bad time in the country when really we're being annihilated and hunted down and exterminated, the small political movement, because we hold the wrong beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a very concerted effort from both the right and the left to stifle free speech and inquiry into certain ideas that threaten some very powerful forces out there. Now, one thing that you said earlier that was very interesting was that, you initially started criticizing Israel from an economic standpoint, correct? Like, hey, we're giving them absurd amounts of money. Maybe we should kind of tone that down a little bit, or see whether or not we could spend our money and in better ways, right? And it yeah. sounds like you were under attack from Ben Shapiro and his cronies, who, let's face it, are largely Jewish. So they might be coming, you're raising these economic concerns and they're responding with essentially, ethnic concerns. I think that's pretty interesting because those are the same people who then turn around and say, no, the alt-right is wrong because it's identity politics, because it's, white people thinking, in terms of ethnic consciousness and so forth. But it's a very interesting political landscape these days.
Well, yeah, and there's so many black and white examples of this. Take Elliot Hamilton, for example, who is basically Ben Shapiro's number two man. He's basically Ben Shapiro's toilet paper in terms of his content, his slavish devotion to this man. And you can look through his entire timeline, and it is at once extremely opposed to identity politics, super against the alt-right, white nationalism. He says really a lot of unintelligent, just defamatory things about the alt-right. And then at the same time, concurrently, woven throughout all those criticisms of identity politics and the alt-right, you have this like zealot commitment to Jewish nationalism, to extreme Zionism, borderline ethnic cleansing against Palestinians. And it just bewilders me how the normal conservative, just a regular guy, going to the Daily Wire for news about, Donald Trump or what's going on in North Korea, how they don't see like, hey, wait a minute, there's kind of a glaring contradiction in who these people proclaim to be and what they purport their ideology to be.
Yeah, and it's so transparent that it's really understandable why people are coming over to the alt-right. They see this massive double standard, and they see the really disingenuous ways in which people such as Ben Shapiro and so forth respond when you raise these, legitimate criticisms. But why don't we talk a little bit about the Reagan Battalion? What can you tell us about them?
Well, I can't spill the beans too much. I know there's money on the line. Chuck Johnson put up a bounty of 10 grand for people to dox them, to rat out who funds it, who founded it, who operates the Twitter account.
Okay.
And so what I've gathered and what I've seen for the most part, this is like, it operates as a Twitter account. That's where all their followers are. And it operates as a bastion of boomer conservatism. And really it is, I think, the attack dog of a very specific group of Republicans, let's say, of establishment Republicans. They've gone after Milo. They've gone after Tommy Lahren. Right now they're concentrating on Ward, who's running in, I think, is it Arizona against Jeff Flake and myself. And I can't spill the beans on who they are just yet, but it will be coming out very shortly exactly who is behind that account.
Okay. That's really interesting. Yeah, I didn't know there was a bounty on the Reagan Battalion, but with $10,000 on the line, I'm sure there's a paper trail that someone's going to pick up. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. You've suffered attacks from both the right and the left. Would you say that you've been attacked from one side more than the other?
Well, it's difficult to say only because, just this week in particular has been really hectic. I mean, I've gotten really an insane amount of hate mail, like hate mail that no person should have to get, at least nobody that doesn't have institutional resources or even a blue check mark on Twitter, where I'm getting thousands of messages a day calling me a Nazi, saying Fuentes is the name of my housekeeper. I mean, just the most horrible things. And things I wouldn't want to say on the program, I don't want to get too explicit.
Thank you.
But no problem. And for really the longest time, though, I will say this has been the exception. In my experience, for the past 9 to 12 months, almost all of the criticism, almost all of the attacks have been from fellow conservatives. They've been the most consistent. Cassie Dillon called my employer at Right Side Broadcasting every day for 2 weeks to say, look at what Nick posted on Twitter. Look at what Nick said on his show. Look, fire Nick, get him off the show. And Ben Shapiro has got his cadre of staff writers and flying monkeys on me. Right. And it's really, I think it really says something about this ideology of quote-unquote conservatism, just how much of a farce it is, that it just is built on top of so many contradictions and built on top of so many hypocrisies that it's clear that it will not, I don't think it will last throughout the Trump presidency. And I think that's what you're starting to see with Charlottesville.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the biggest things Trump has done for us is delegitimize conservatism, Inc., and kind of spur this new, rise of nationalism and so forth. But yeah, it's very interesting that forces on the right have essentially adopted Antifa tactics to shut down, discussion and expression of certain ideas, ranging from multiculturalism to the double standard regarding Israel and so forth. It's, we don't live it under a hard totalitarian regime in such a situation that would involve, the secret police coming and, beating you over the head for saying the wrong thing on the internet or something. But we do live under soft totalitarianism, which is, you can say what you want, but you're going to lose your job. You're going to lose all your social capital. You're going to be banned from, various places on the internet. Daily Stormer, granted, far more volatile than most on the right, but they have just gotten to the point where it's not even about hosting. It's not about, all these other things. It's just being able to get a domain registry is, they've been having so many issues with that. And it's a really hard thing to kind of go around. Interestingly, they were kicked off of Cloudflare because the CEO of Cloudflare said that he just woke up and, was in a bad mood, thought Andrew England was an asshole, and decided to kick him off. Now, this is a person who previously declined to kick off ISIS from his platform. These are people that are engaged in wholesale rape, slaughter, conquest, and so forth. And it really goes to show that it's really a war of ideas. You can kill people, you can rape people, you can blow up buildings, but you won't be as bad as the person who challenges the status quo ideologically. So it is very powerful. And it's very disturbing to see that coming from the right as well. But,
And that's a good way to put it when you say soft totalitarianism. I'm going to have to start using that. And it's so true that someone like Ben Shapiro, he shows up to Berkeley, he shows up to DePaul University, and he's the fighting champion of free speech and free discourse and the open market of ideas. And then he goes on the Rubin Report and he says that, the real racists should be hunted down, have their careers ruined and everything else.
Yeah.
And you think, how free of a country are we living in that you can't get a website if you have the wrong ideas? And they say, the First Amendment only protects you from government. Well, if you think about what government means, if you think about what it means to govern a society, is the public sector really the most dominant force, or do we live in a country that's governed by mega corporations and mega banks and a shadowy ruling elite who seems to have their fingers in everything? And so I think when you have all these free speech warriors, they make it their only cause, and they make it this, it's the number one thing, it's the most important. All these 20 something young conservatives in the chubby shorts going to the frat parties calling themselves conservatives, it really, I think, a false idol. It is a false cause. There has to be something more to it. Free speech is the instrument to get something much broader accomplished.
Yeah, and it's really ironic that the people that put free speech as an end in and of itself seem to be the same ones, resorting to the slander, the smear campaigns, trying to get you fired for having the wrong, opinions. It's all very disgusting. And as I was saying before, it's very disingenuous and it's very transparent. That's why people are coming to the alt-right. Many people come to the alt-right just out of sheer disgust for all other options, both right and left. So I think that is, very, very reassuring for people, on the alt-right or the nationalist dissident right, whatever you want to call it. But so your response to these witch hunts hasn't been to cuck. You haven't, given in. You haven't tried to concede, which I think is very intelligent. And I think that's something perhaps you picked up from Trump. Would you say that you did, or maybe you're just kind of a stubborn guy otherwise?
No, that's actually a very keen observation. You're surprisingly, you're the first
maybe
one
a bit of
actually
both.
to say that. Well, it may be a little bit of both, but that's actually so true, and so few people, I think, have noticed that. Some people, it's funny because they'll say, I have a lot of the mannerisms of Trump. I tweet like Trump. You know, we want to imitate winners.
Yep.
We want to imitate people that have succeeded against the left. And, you know, it's sort of like a fake it till you make it, where you copy the style, you copy everything on the surface until you can really get down the fundamentals. And I think so few people are really actively thinking about who are people that are winning. What does it mean to win? How can we emulate those strategies at the micro level, at the level of 8,000 followers compared to, you know, Trump's 36 million? And so absolutely, when I look at how Trump handled the primary and then the general election, you saw that at no point was he apologizing. At no point did he allow the left or even the establishment conservatives to control the narrative. And so that was a huge inspiration when dealing with the Reagan Battalion, where they came out with a video that for all intents and purposes should have been the end of my career. I mean, that should have been it. They had me saying things, you know, apparently that were racist and anti-Semitic. I mean, you don't recover from things like that, generally speaking. But because I was there and a lot of people had my back to flip the narrative and say, well, why do you hate white people? Why are you using these tactics? Why is it me you're going after? And on and on. I think people really started to see that there is an alternative. I think people are starting to see that there is a way that we can fight back against that, even at the lower levels. We don't have to have $1 billion. You just have to emulate those strategies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Trump gave us a model for how to defeat the left, how to defeat political correctness, at least, you know, kind of in this day and age, maybe not, you know, a complete worldview to defeat, you know, the left for the next, you know, few hundred centuries. But he showed us how to, you know, to double down once you get attacked and to not give in. Once you give in, when you are called a racist, when you're called an anti-Semite, when you're, you know, shamed for having the wrong opinion, you are therefore declaring yourself to be the weaker party. You are submitting. And once the left, you know, detects any weakness, they're just going to keep going until you have submitted 100%. It never works. We've seen it time and time again. You know, a very salient example of this is Trump's response to Charlottesville. At first, he came out and one of his original statements was something to the effect of racism is evil. I think he imagined that was a statement that everyone more or less could agree with and that would kind of get them off of his back. But it didn't work out. That wasn't enough for them. So they ended up going after him. They ended, lambasting him and so forth. And what did he do? He came out and went, apparently deviated from the script to speak from the heart. And, you know, in typical Trump, you know, fiery fashion, he called out the media for, you know, for what they said about him and not accepting, you know, his phrase. And then he said a bunch of things that were, you know, far less acceptable to them. And, you know, his supporters loved it. So, yeah, you're right. Trump has given us a model. And I think, you know, future conservatives and, you know, right wingers, nationalists in America looking to be involved in politics should absolutely follow his model.
Well, yeah, and so many of these young people, I think really the young people are the problem because people that don't care. I think those two go hand in hand. People that are young, immature, inexperienced, and they come up, watching the Turning Point USA propaganda, and they get into college. They think they know everything. They think they have all the answers, but they don't really care enough to see what is going to succeed. And if anyone would stop and think for a moment and evaluate what you're going to get out of it if you cuck on the racism or on the Nazi accusation and you say, you know, oh, well, of course we condemn racism and we apologize and that's not what real conservatism is. If people would stop and evaluate and say, what are we going to get from that? What is going to be the end result? What will the conversation be? I think Trump, what he did is he got us thinking tactically. He got us thinking tactically as opposed to ideologically and sort of changed, I think, how we thought about the electorate before. Whereas the George W. Bush establishment wanted us to think in terms of how can we appeal to minorities and blacks and Democrats.
Right.
I think Trump made us realize, no, you just have to tell the truth. You just have to appeal. And you can also exclusively appeal to white people and still win the election, you know, in terms of how can we maximize our potential given what we have, which is very little institutionally.
Absolutely. So, Nick, what were some of the issues that you kind of touched on that the Reagan Battalion and others were unhappy with you for? You know, what were some of the kind of positions you take or you took back then that kind of were the source of these attacks on you?
It was almost exclusively the Israel issue, almost exclusively. Oh, yeah, isn't that something?
Really,
right?
Really makes you think.
Yeah, really activates the almonds that, you know, I came out pretty vociferously against the foreign aid because, you know, for most people, I think they just sort of get massaged into this blind submission to the Israel lobby. You know, they go from, because you go on Daily Wire and every other story is crush Palestine with the might of the hammer of David.
Right.
And people just get massaged into it where it's like, you fight for low taxes, support Israel 100%. Leftists are crazy. Israel's enemies will be destroyed. And so people just kind of get into that. But I was always of the mind, and I saw this pattern, and I said, you know, we have to put America first. I understand, you know, you can like Israel. Maybe Israel's great, but $3.8 billion a year for a decade, and you read the Israel lobby, and you understand all the other very exclusive beneficial provisions given to Israel and everything else, and then you look into the Iraq war and certain other things going on in the Middle East right now, like going on in the Golan Heights. And then you really realize that this is a massive scandal that no one is talking about, that everyone who has money seems to be lying about. And that was the one issue that Reagan Battalion really took offense with me over. That was the initial issue. And almost every issue since then has been, I think, motivated in part by that.
Very interesting. Yeah, there are a whole, there are many double standards regarding Israel and Zionism and so forth. Obviously, there is the, you know, kind of the issue with funding, for example. The one that really gets to me is the attitude that many neocons, you know, Jews on the right, to take towards multiculturalism. Many of them are very explicit about the fact that, you know, multiculturalism is, you know, great for the West, but terrible for Israel. And look, I don't advocate indiscriminately hating Jewish people. I don't think they're all part of some, like, you know, crazy plot or whatever. But, you know, that is a problem. That is something that is very, you know, it's very selfish, and it's not conducive to good relations within, you know, the you know, with you know, within the American right and so forth. Because for them to demand that we, you know, give them special privileges and, you know, that we don't get in order to cooperate with them, in order to exist within right-wing politics in America, that's very unfair. And I think younger generations are kind of starting to get that, you know. Why do we give Israel so much, you know, so much of this money? You know, looking at where Israel spends money, you know, IsraAid is an NGO that gets funding from the Israeli government, and their whole purpose is to relocate refugees, not to Israel, but to Europe. They are literally on beaches helping people, you know, helping these quote unquote refugees, which are generally just, you know, economic migrants, all male, land in Europe. So it's a pretty bad situation. And this whole atmosphere of political correctness, frankly, let's face it, even though, you know, these people on the right, like Ben Shapiro and so forth, are right wing, they are politically correct. And you cannot criticize, you know, Jewish organizations, Israel, without being anti-Semitic. So this whole anti-dialogical atmosphere, I think, makes it very hard to just kind of have an honest discussion on these issues.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and you got Ben Shapiro saying again that you go after and you ruin these people. So, I mean, when you have one side that can say whatever it wants and one side that has a home to return to if this whole social experiment doesn't work out, and on this side, on the side of the alternative viewpoint that is opposed by the media, the government, academia, everyone else, and on top of that, if you talk about it, you get fired. It's a totally asymmetrical playing field. And, you know, Ben Shapiro, he'll tweet about how he opposes the quote-unquote Browning, or rather, he has no problem with the quote-unquote Browning of America. Just 10 years ago, he calls for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. He says,
right,
stop being squeamish, destroy their homes, drive them from the Holy Land. And, you know, that's not to say, I always say this on my show, that's not to say we don't like him for saying that. That's not to say, like, we hate people for saying that. It's to say that everyone should be afforded that same right. Everyone should be afforded that same right to self-determination, or at least the right to talk about it. But, you know, like you said, it's just not allowed. It's just not acceptable. It's not couth. It's not in the Overton window. And I think unless and until people stop being afraid of being called racist, it's going to continue like that. But I think a lot of people see that the alternative is so much worse if we don't speak up,
right,
that it's becoming a lot less scary to talk about it, because they see what's going on in Europe and they say, you know, gee, get called the racist or migrant rape gangs, you know, and then it becomes a little bit easier. Yeah, it's tough to say because, you know, you call yourself a conservative and you get lumped in with all these idiots from the think tanks.
Right.
I mean, I still would call myself a conservative in the tradition of Otto von Bismarck or, you know, Cato the Elder. I mean,
yeah,
real conservatives. But
people that actually conserve things, right?
Yes, right. I mean, I had a debate with Will Nardi the other day, who calls himself a conservative. And then I point out to him all of the things that were going on in 1776, and everyone is racist and sexist and everything else. And I say, okay, so Will, you know, you're really trying to conserve something that never really existed. You're trying to conserve something that was born in, like, a Harvard sociology department in the 1970s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I hate calling myself a conservative now, but I think, you know, if we're trying to reappropriate that word, I would call myself actually, you know, a traditionalist conservative. Maybe that's the way to say it.
Yeah, I think I like that phrase. That's perhaps a little more fitting. Yeah, I mean, the issue with contemporary, you know, mainstream conservatives, they have a very Whiggish view, a very flawed view of American history. And I think that's one of the biggest things that the alt-right needs to do, you know, it's kind of the nationalist right overall, is to kind of remind these people that, hey, this America that you're, this story you're telling about American history is factually inaccurate. You know, this idea that it was created to be this multiracial, feminist, transgender, whatever, you know, country, but it had free markets. That's just so patently absurd.
Yeah, it's hilarious to me that anyone believes that's the case, because I think if you put it plainly to people like that, it's such an easy thing to understand. Like, okay, Will Nardi, Ben Shapiro, Cassie Dillon, you're telling me that if I went back to George Washington and I said, George, we're trying to conserve your vision of a place where gay people can smoke pot and have assault rifles and, you know, the kids are degenerates,
right,
and there's blacks and Muslims and Asians and there's no majority race and there's no majority religion and basically everyone's an atheist and they balloon up to 500 pounds eating soy and grease. Like, does anybody think that that is the case?
I'm sure some of them do, but yeah, anyone who's intellectually honest, I think, is able to kind of see, you know, kind of see through that. They'd also have to be, you know, relatively intelligent, which is perhaps more than you can say for many mainstream conservatives without, you know, naming any names. But I mean, you have the Naturalization Act of 1790 that explicitly stated America was to be, you know, a white nation for, you know, white people of good moral character. So that pretty much rules out, you know, a large segment of people in America today. And for the record, I'm not, you know, advocating that we just, you know, ship all of these people out because the founding fathers wanted it to be all white or anything. Obviously, you know, we've kind of inherited this situation. So I think we should look for, you know, reasonable ways to kind of remedy, you know, some of the various issues ranging from, you know, the social degeneracy to demographics and so forth. But yeah, I think one of the big things that modern conservatives and even the alt-light, which is perhaps a bit more nationalistic than Conservatism Inc., one of the things that they harp on all the time is the evils of identity politics. So why don't you kind of give me your perspective on what you consider identity politics to be and whether or not they are in fact a, you know, terrible thing.
Well, yeah, I tend to agree, and this is, this will be a shocker to a lot of people, but I tend to agree with the sort of alt-right idea, which is that all identity, or rather all politics, is identity politics. Yeah. I don't understand how you can step outside of that and pretend for a moment that in a multi-ethnic, multicultural country, or at least we're heading in that direction, you could absolve people from their racial, ethnic, cultural background and say, we're going to just talk about the top marginal tax rate and Medicare. It just doesn't happen. And so I think that identity politics, generally speaking, I think is not a great way to order society, only because you only have identity politics when you have a multi-ethnic, multicultural country. And when you're at that point, I think it ceases to be a coherent single nation, and you're already too far gone. So I would say that right now, identity politics is unfortunately required. I see it as a necessary evil because of the people at the top that have been controlling the immigration policy and the monetary policy for so long, they've made it so that white people are just another in a group of competing ethnic factions. You know, for now, we're going to have to play that game. But we want to get it to a point where there is a coherent national identity and we can vote and talk based on the national interest. But I don't think you have that coherent national interest when you have all these factions. I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to kind of compound things, these days, assimilation, which used to be kind of the prescribed norm for most of American history, assimilation is now seen as something oppressive and racist. To even urge people, you know, new immigrants to come here, learn the language, assimilate into American culture. I mean, we're at the point now where that is considered to be racist. So it's just really absurd. I mean, I think the logical conclusion of all of these leftist, progressive, you know, liberal policies is just, you know, social entropy. It's chaos. It's a very disjointed society where people don't have much in common linguistically, racially, religiously, and so forth. So it's just a very, you know, it's a very bad model for civilization. And, you know, there's this whole anti-dialogical atmosphere that prevents people from talking about these issues. And as a result of that, all of the evidence that we have about the ills of multiculturalism doesn't get touched on. For example, Robert Putnam wrote the book Bowling Alone. He did a lot of, academic research. This guy was a Harvard sociologist and so forth. And he studied the effects of ethnic diversity on society, I believe here in America. And, you know, he found that virtually all of the parameters that he measured, from social trust to the desire to, you know, participate in civic life, to the desire to, contribute to the commons, you know, as in like funding a park or so forth, all of these things declined as society became more and more diverse. So, yeah, I mean, this stuff doesn't enter into the conversation, though. So I think one of the biggest things that we can do is really just kind of break down the barriers and, you know, just get our facts out there. And I think that's why they do censor us so much. But yeah, back to the notion of identity politics, it is, you know, it is a really fundamental thing. Part of the whole Trump phenomenon, you can't look at that and not see it as, you know, largely a kind of a racial struggle. 90%, upwards of 90% of people who voted for Trump were white. Granted, our whites are the majority, but, 10% of blacks voted for Trump, 25% of Hispanics, I think a similar amount of Asians, a similar amount of Jews. So it's, and the left, they saw Trump as a white thing, an implicitly white thing. So yeah, you know, in a multicultural society, you're not going to be able to have sober discussions on immigration, because, you know, in order to raise wages, you might have to limit, you know, the amount of another group that comes in, and then the people in that group who are already here aren't going to, they're not going to like that because they want to, you know, get their family over and so forth. But yeah, it's all a pretty bad situation, but, I think people are kind of waking up to all of this.
Yeah, it's very messy. And you'd think all these people that are championing diversity and multiculturalism, I've yet to see a single example where this model has succeeded. I mean, these are people that want to put our whole country, our whole inheritance as a civilization on the line in pursuit of what I perceive to be a social experiment, which is, yeah, what the hell? Let's just, you know, Africans, Muslims, Asians, Latin Americans, you know, let's just throw them all in big cities, cut off all their roots,
see what happens.
Take away the gods. Yeah, what the hell? It'll probably work. I mean, it's good. It's our biggest strength. Like,
right.
If you look at the most diverse countries in the world, Brazil, Ethiopia, you know, the Congo, Russia, and you say, why are these not superpowers? Why are these not, you know, how come you can't walk down the street like you can in Norway or Sweden or Denmark? You know, point to me the diversity superpower of the world, and I'll tell you, you've got something. I'll say, okay, we can consider that. But you look around the world where you have different ethnicities, nationalities, religions, from Nigeria to Ukraine to Brazil, and it's just a horrendous failure. There is not one data point that points to this being a viable trajectory for the country. And to even talk about this, to even, you know, literally just question what has been the dogma for 50 years, and you can't feed your family anymore. I don't understand. This is not a way to govern a country. This is not a way to
determine
the course of a country.
Right. You know, I think the kind of end goal, the desired outcome for all of this is the dissolution of Western nation states and the formation of some kind of global, you know, more open, you know, I'm hesitant to use the word civilization, but I mean, it's going to be like a global, you know, plantation essentially with where most people are going to be serfs. And then there's going to be, you know, an elite who are making, you know, Facebook apps and whatever else, lording, you know, the soy bug man, you know, aristocracy lording over the rest of us. A very, very terrifying vision of the future. But you know, it's not working. And I think what makes it worse is just this obsession with equality too, right? Mm. I think multiculturalism, the kind of the downsides of it would be lessened if we weren't obsessed with the idea that all groups need to be equally represented everywhere, right? Women need to be equally represented in, you know, the CEOs, you know, as CEOs and, you know, major tech, you know, business companies and so forth, not so much coal miners and construction workers, because that's, you know, because reasons, I guess. But and also the idea that, you know, all different racial groups need to, you know, have the same outcomes essentially, right? Because the first kind of progressive liberal push was for equality of opportunity. We want to make sure that, you know, the black guy down the street, the Asian guy down the street, the Hispanic woman, they're all able to succeed. They're all able to succeed and to achieve their potential. But within a meritocracy, you know, not everyone is going to, you know, obviously be able to do that. But we've moved beyond that now. We're kind of post, you know, equality of opportunities. Now it's equality of outcomes. The prevailing narrative for this is that if there are differences in group outcomes, if, say, blacks don't do as well on the SATs as, you know, Asians, then it is the result of white racism. And yeah, you know, as we spoke about earlier, there are these kind of deeply ingrained issues with multiculturalism. But then you add this equality nonsense in there on top of it, and it is just, you know, it's a disaster, frankly. It's very hard to kind of defend it at this point unless you've drank the progressive Kool-Aid, essentially.
Well, yeah, and they're trying to fit people into this vision that is impossible. And this is really, I think, broadly, everything that this new nationalist movement stands for is about recognizing the limitations of people and tribes and what it means to be human, but then using those limitations to optimize and maximize our potential. Whereas you see these idealists, these postmodernists, the globalists, they, in a very vain and arrogant attempt to resist these limitations and to defy them because of ideology, they then create a lot of inefficiencies. And in trying to force them into this vision, I think lower us drastically in terms of what we're able to accomplish. I mean, you think of major corporations, major companies, and really any organization, and you put in a diversity program, instantaneously the efficiency and the output of that organization goes down.
Yep.
And that's because instead of recognizing the limitations of people and ordering them based on merit or based on truth or based on statistics, we're trying to force people, we're trying to force square pegs into round holes in pursuit of an ideological vision, which nobody seems to understand where it came from or why it's just or why we're pursuing it.
So, Nick, let's talk about the future of right-wing politics in America. As we've kind of touched on already in the show, there's been this transition from, you know, Conservatism Inc., which is focused on free markets, you know, freedom of speech and so forth, above everything else. But now that's kind of transitioning into, you know, more of a nationalistic, more of a, you know, economic populist, you know, kind of perspective. So where do you think all of this is heading?
Well, it's tough to say. I think really this is a time for choosing for the right wing. But I think that ultimately the people will make the right choice. I think that President Trump is a genius in terms of his framing, his pacing with regards to ideology, the argument, generally speaking, in the media, and with regards to how he's manipulating is maybe a bad word, but sort of coaching people in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think that with him at the helm of the Republican Party, I think that will do a lot of good because he's honest, he's open, he's very likable, really to a point where I think he might be the guy that takes us where we need to go, takes us away from the Bush, the Paul Ryan party, into the party of nationalism. Fundamentally, I think you see this with Tucker Carlson at the helm of Fox News. I think that's really a symbolic and symptomatic expression that says the people are not in the Bill O'Reilly zone. They're not in the no spin zone anymore.
Right.
They're in the Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity zone. You look at the rise of Breitbart, the ascendancy of Breitbart and other things like that, the complete collapse of National Review, Bill Kristol, a lot of these old guard conservatives. And I think 2018, 2020 will be a referendum on where conservatives are. And I think that will, however it is determined in 2018 and 2020, I think that will be the benchmark and the litmus test for where we're going to go for the next 25, 100 years.
Yeah, this past election has been, you know, it was incredible. I don't think there has ever been an election like that. So I'm very excited, perhaps a bit anxious about the next one. I think it's going to be, you know, people have speculated that Trump might not run again. I think that's kind of it's really far-fetched, but, you know, we'll see. But assuming he does run, I think we will be in for another wild ride, which I'm, you know, definitely looking forward to. But yeah, I think we are moving away from Conservatism Inc. And I think that plays a large role in all of these attacks on you. I think people like Ben Shapiro, Rick Wilson, you know, all of these neoconservatives, all of these, you know, just GOP hacks, you know, establishment friendly types, they see that, you know, people like you, people like James Alsup, I think kind of represent the future of what right-wing politics is going to be in America. It's going to be America first. It's going to be nationalist. It's not going to shy away from issues like identity, like multiculturalism. It's not going to be afraid to, you know, level, you know, the most reasonable of criticism against Israel, which I think is a very good thing. So, yeah, I mean, again, I think things are moving in the right direction. And the feeling of, you know, getting left behind is very palpable among the, you know, essentially the people attacking you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that people are really just sick and tired of the status quo. You know, we can talk about ideology and people on the alt-right and on the conservative Inc. We love to go back and forth about the finer points of identity politics and Israel and other things. But I think really for the common man, I think it just comes down to they know that what's going on isn't working. They know that something is wrong. Something is very, very wrong. I was in my barbershop the other day. The guy that's cutting my hair, he's a total normie. I love him to death. He's a great guy, but total normie. And even he is saying, well, you know, I'm really running low on white guilt. The tank is basically empty. and they know, just people that watch, people that are on Reddit, people that watch television, people that watch Rick and Morty, they know something's wrong here. And so I think that at the end of the day is what's going to do it for us.
Yeah, I certainly agree. You know, people like that have, you know, they just, they haven't gone through the indoctrination process that, you know, you or I have been subjected to. You know, obviously we came out of it or perhaps didn't give into it fully, but they haven't been through like the white privilege classes. They haven't, you know, been told that Western civilization is the worst thing ever by all of their college professors. So they just hear bits and pieces of it. And it's, I mean, that has to be pretty, pretty perturbing to them, just hearing, like, because they're not familiar with it is what I'm trying to say. They just see it, they're just hearing snippets of it, and they're like, you know, what is going on? You know, right. the left really overplayed their hand with this, because, you know, this is something that's coming from cities, coming from universities, essentially, and the people creating this live in this very liberal bubble. All of the people they associate with are fellow liberal elites, you know, champagne socialists and whatever else. So they think it's perfectly reasonable to talk about how, you know, essentially white people need to be erased through mass immigration, through miscegenation, through low birth rates, however it's done. You know, diversity will lead to less white people, and that is a good thing. And to them, that sounds reasonable. It sounds self-evident, frankly. But yeah, to the average, you know, the average white guy, or perhaps even not the average white guy, the average, you know, conservative of any race who hears that stuff, you know, that is... they're not going to buy into it. And, you know, thankfully Donald Trump came along when he did. If Donald Trump came along, you know, if this awakening happened, say 20 to 30 years down the line, when America's demographics tipped towards a non-white majority, I think we would have, I mean, we absolutely would have found ourselves in a far more tenuous and trying situation. But yeah, what are your thoughts on the kind of the stuff that's being taught in college with regard to, you know, white guilt, white, you know, whiteness shaming, and whatever else? It seems like every day we hear about some new absurd, you know, story coming out of the universities.
Well, I think it's pretty wacky that people are not drawing this parallel. I was talking about this on Twitter earlier, but I think of this as well. You know, if there were professors that were neo-Nazis and they were teaching kids this very ideological, this very extremist point of view and paradigm of how to judge people and politics, it would be a national scandal. If they were teaching classes, for example, about how, you know, all the politics and science of race, and they were teaching them about the science of National Socialism,
right?
Outrage, you know, you'd never hear the end of it. But yet it seems that every university is just saturated with neo-Marxists and Bolsheviks and communists, yeah, teaching people how identity isn't real, how race isn't real, everything is a construct. These really extremist, ideological, borderline extremist, ontological views, and this is, eh, well, that's crazy liberal college. That's not acceptable. And even beyond the curriculum, I think a lot of young people can understand that the curriculum is a little bit BS. Even my liberal friends understand this. But really, at the base level, what the college experience is corrupting our people, which is the drug abuse, the alcohol abuse, the sexual hedonism, the Absolutely. Sexual degeneracy. I mean, I think at the fundamental level, the campus has become a place where they crank out, you know, neo-Bolshevik reactionary, or rather radical activists. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, the people that aren't affected by that are churned out to be these soulless, rootless herd animals that are just meant to go out and have good sex and get drunk and high all the time. So I would say for most people, you got to steer clear of the college.
Yeah, and particularly for girls, it's a very threatening thing. You know, the story of Moldilocks is one that that I always think of with regard to college indoctrination. You know, Moldilocks, for anyone who is unaware, she, you know, was at the Battle of Berkeley. She was punched in the face by Nathan D'Amigo after she was throwing bottles at people. She all had a knife on her. She was talking about how she was going there to, you know, collect Nazi sculpts, self-avowed, you know, radical communist and so forth. There are pictures of her prior to going to UC Berkeley. She's blonde. She's wearing a nice dress. She looks happy. She looks healthy. And then the pictures of her after, you know, like, I think it was like, what, a year or two of Berkeley? It wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even the full 4 to 5 years. She's doing some kind of weird fetish porn where she's involving having body hair in places where, you know, like in her, you know, under her arms and wherever else. I guess that's kind of a niche that some people are into. And And, you know, she's just wearing all black. She looks, you know, big, you know, bags under her eyes. She looks just objectively worse afterwards. And it is very troubling. You're very correct to point out both the Marxist indoctrination and the degeneracy that kind of ensues or, you know, goes along with it. I think the right generally is founded more on the idea of virtue, of people aspiring for, you know, kind of self-betterment and so forth, having high standards, whereas the left is more permissive. It's more about, you know, just being, you know, a free spirit man and whatever else. Like, you don't do drugs, have promiscuous sex, ignore all of the statistical, you know, biological information about, you know, how certain some of these habits and, you know, ways of behaving are destructive because, you know, it's freedom or whatever else. But yeah, it's college. It's going to take a while to truly liberate college. You know, it took a while for the leftists to really just kind of infest universities, but we're kind of seeing the results of that now. You know, the manufacture of culture is kind of paramount in society, and whoever is in control of college, you know, the university system is going to have a monopoly on that.
Yeah, I don't know how we're going to get that back. I mean, that code is going to be really tough to crack. These are things, the things that they've broken, that these people have broken, are nearly impossible to put back together again. When you're talking about cohesion, when you're talking about personal responsibility, virtue, religion, I mean, these are things that very, very few times in history are able to be resurrected once they're gone.
Yeah.
And so this task that this generation is up to is Herculean. I mean, and the best part is, you know, even if we had a free press, even if we had free speech, even if we could talk about these things, we could print pamphlets and newspapers and we could talk about it on television, you know, even if so many things were pointing in the right direction, if we were trying our hardest to get it to where it needs to go, it still couldn't be enough. It still might not be enough. And you can't even talk about it. That's not even the case. So it's going to be a miracle. It's going to be a miracle if we make it out. But I think we have the will to do it.
I certainly think we do as well. And I think, you know, it's kind of hard to determine like the right course of action. Like, you know, what is the one thing that we can do? Or what is the one distinct path that we can follow to, you know, achieve our aims, to turn things around and, you know, start kind of a new chapter of Western civilization. But while, you know, while there isn't one, you know, way of doing things, so to speak, or at least we haven't discovered it yet, there are things we can do that will lead to victory in one way or another. I think the biggest one, and what the Trump movement and the alt-right have been most successful at, is essentially winning over hearts and minds, getting the information out, getting our narrative out. You know, when people realize these things, it is a very existential transformation that they go through. It's, you know, taking the red pill, as we call it. And, you know, if we can, you know, this is something Richard Spencer says quite often. If every white person, or you can just say every person in the West, was aware of what was going on, it would be, you know, it would be a walk in the park to turn things around. So that's how I always see it. It's just a question of how many people we can win over, because we'll get to that point eventually when we have enough people, we have enough quality people, I should add, that we can do anything, frankly. So Nick, it's been a good talk. Let's start wrapping up a little bit here. I don't think we covered kind of some of the fallout from what you've, you know, these attacks on you. How has your life been affected?
Well, it's been really a tough time. I mean, my parents have been harassed. People in my family have been harassed. My college has been harassed. And, you know, really at this point, after so many controversies, no one has a crystal ball. You can't see into the long term. But at the present moment, I'm basically unemployable. And if I applied to most colleges, I think I'd have a very tough time getting in. And, you know, it just goes to show that for all of these so-called free speech activists, I know, you know, we've sort of been here before, but really on a personal level, people that I know on a very personal level, my friends who I've met in this sick Conservative Inc. think tank network, who will talk to me and wax dramatically and rhapsodize about free speech and, you know, liberty of thought and expression, and those very people – are going to be the ones that bury me in terms of a possible non-political career in the private sector or an education even at a public university. It just goes to show that we do not live in a free country anymore. We do not live in a free society. And we laugh at the North Koreans, we laugh at the Russians, and we pity them. We think, you know, how sad and unfortunate it must be to not know freedom. And, you know, the funny thing about democracy is it's those very people that laugh at them that are imprisoned in their own mind, that are imprisoned and they're not even aware of it. I think that's the most heinous and the most despicable form of tyranny, that they're not even aware of their bonds. They're not even aware that they are in shackles. And that's, you know, if you want to get into neo-reactionary theory, I think that's why democracy perhaps is the most perverse, because it requires people to believe these lies, to buy into this really perverse system. And so on a personal level, it has been really, I think, a time of deep thought, of brooding, of discovering just how sick the system is when you experience it on that very intimate level.
Yeah, it sounds like you've certainly been put through the ringer. You actually had to leave the university you were attending in Boston, correct?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of death threats, so I had to get out of Boston. Very dangerous city.
Yeah, we saw the free speech rally that took place there. I think there were about 20 to 30 free speech advocates. You know, God bless them. But I do actually I will give them credit, even though they're probably some degree of alt-right and probably have a lot of ideas with which I disagree. But, you know, they went out there to support Donald Trump, to support free speech, two things that I support as well. And it does take courage to kind of, stand up against the left in person, given their numbers. Yeah, there is the picture of them in the gazebo, just surrounded on all sides by thousands of protesters. That one was very profound. But Boston, probably not the best place to be right wing. That's kind of the point of all of that. So, Nick, why don't you tell everyone where they can find, your work and your presence on the internet?
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at Nick J. Fuentes and Facebook.com/Nick J. Fuentes. I'm working on a new website where you can find all my content that should be finished by Friday, I believe, by this weekend. And that's just NicholasJFuentes.com. And then you can just check out my Twitter for updates about my two new podcasts, which start on Saturday and then on Monday.
Well, Nick, thanks again for coming on. We'll definitely have to do this again in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.